It's a deathbed scene. Jacob is coming to the end of his life. He is soon to die. And as he feels his body weakening, he calls his sons together. An act of that was common to his day, an act in which he would bless his sons with information and appeal with regard to their future, their destinies. Not perhaps the destinies of the immediate generation, but perhaps for generations to follow. We've seen it before in the words of the patriarchs, and we see it now in the words of Jacob. In fact, they're interesting words because I think if it was left to us, we would hardly describe some of them as blessings. They're rather cursings. But nevertheless, they come under this banner of the final words on the deathbed of Jacob, a blessing upon his sons. Perhaps the deathbed is the time for leaving the past behind and looking to the future. Certainly for those who will remain, for those who have life in them, that would be the focus. What does the future hold? Let's leave the past. But Jacob doesn't leave the past. The past often catches up with us eventually, and that would certainly be true of some of the sons of Jacob in these verses. There's three things that I want to really draw out from these verses, three very basic, pretty simple lessons for us. And the first is that God's ways are not our ways. God's ways are not our ways. Reuben was the firstborn. And the firstborn could have great expectations. And we've seen it before, haven't we? We've seen it in the life of Jacob himself. He wanted the birthright, and he purchased it from his brother by trading a bowl of soup for it. Why? Because the birthright that belonged to the firstborn was a treasure. He also took the blessing of the firstborn by deception. Certainly, we've observed that the firstborn has a special place through virtue of his being the firstborn. And Jacob begins with these very promising words, "Reuben, you are my firstborn." And we can imagine Reuben turning his full attention to his father lying there on his deathbed. "You are my might, the first fruits of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. You are first." But the next words must have pierced Reuben to the heart. Unstable as water, "You shall not have preeminence. Because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." The firstborn, so much to expect, but ruined because of sin. A sin described in the 35th chapter. Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. We don't read of Israel responding to it, of doing anything about it at that time. One commentator suggests that Jacob is fearful. He's afraid of Reuben and what he might do. But here, on his deathbed, all fear is gone. And now at last, Reuben's sin catches up with him. He should be preeminent, but he's lost it all. He should have first place. He should have the rule. He should take the lead. He should be one who all his brothers look up to for guidance. He should have his father's place. The problem was, Reuben had been too impatient for his father's place and had taken the place of his father in his father's bed. And now he has lost that place altogether. No prophet, no judge, no king came from the Reubenites. In fact, the one thing that the sons of Reuben are known for is their rebellion in the days of Moses under the leadership of Korah. When Dathan and Abiram, descendants of Reuben, were swallowed up by the earth along with Korah and his family. Reuben had such great expectations, but such disappointed hopes. Jacob had such great expectations in Reuben. But it was not to be. Why? Because of sin, certainly. But that isn't the only reason. It cannot be the only reason because, as we will see in a moment, he wasn't the only sinner among his brothers. Why then? Why is Reuben then overlooked for the birthright, the place, the position of the firstborn? Because God's ways are not our ways. God's choices are not our choices. God often surprises us in the way that he works, bringing about his purposes by his own wisdom, and not submitting to the wisdom of men. And then, of course, we come to Simeon and Levi. They're the next in line. I'm doubtful that having heard what Jacob had to say concerning Reuben, that they hold out very much hope for a better word from their father. After all, Jacob had turned a blind eye to Reuben's sin during his life, whereas Simeon and Levi had been the objects of his wrath. We see in Jacob's words to them and the outcome of those words in their descendants, the justice of God and the mercy of God. The justice of God and the mercy of God. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Of course, there's an incident that Jacob has in his mind as he speaks these words, an incident in which they slaughtered a whole town. It's recorded for us in the 34th chapter. Not that the town was entirely undeserving. But nevertheless, Simeon and Levi took the law into their own hands. And Jacob said to them on that occasion, "You have brought trouble on me by making me stink to the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My numbers are few, and if they gather themselves against me and attack me, I shall be destroyed, both I and my household." They had acted foolishly, and they had acted in a bloodthirsty way. Weapons of violence are their swords, says Jacob. Let my soul come not into their counsel. Oh, my glory, be not joined to their company. For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. because of the violence of their hearts and hands. Judgment comes upon them. It is just. Simeon and Levi couldn't really expect anything more. They will not receive an inheritance in the land. Well, that's not exactly the whole story. They will receive, but it'll be a scattered portion. It will be a divided portion. They will never be significant. Simeon will in fact be swallowed up in Judah. We have the record of it in Joshua in chapter 19. The lot came out for Simeon, for the tribe of the people of Simeon, according to their clans, and their inheritance was in the midst of the inheritance of the people of Judah. They had for their inheritance, and then there's a number of cities that are mentioned there. This was the inheritance of the tribe of the people of Simeon according to their clans. The inheritance of the people of Simeon formed part of the territory of the people of Judah because the portion of the people of Judah was too large for them. The people of Simeon obtained an inheritance in the midst of their inheritance. And they're swallowed up then by Judah. Levi has no portion at all in the land, apart from some cities. They don't have a region, they don't have an area, they don't have something to pass on from generation to generation like any of the other tribes. This is the outcome for them of these words of Jacob. They will be scattered in Israel. But we see in the lives of the Levites the mercy of God at work. While they are scattered among the people, they are given a particular task to undertake. The Levites become the priestly tribe. In Joshua chapter 18, their allotment is described. And in verse 7, it simply states for us that the Levites have no portion among you, for the priesthood of the Lord is their heritage. And Gad and Reuben and the half tribe of Manasseh have received their inheritance beyond the Jordan eastward, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave them. No portion for the Levites. Their heritage is the priesthood of the Lord. Now, how is it that a people like Levi should become priests of God? What is it that caused this turn of events? Well, the reason for it is to be found in Exodus. When the people of Israel were gathered at Mount Sinai, you'll remember how Moses was up upon the mountain for days on end, and the children of Israel heard nothing from him. And they ended up asking Aaron to make for them a golden calf that they would worship as God. You'll remember how Moses came down and he heard the noise of partying, and he broke those command tablets on which the commandments of God had been put. And on that day, he called for those who were loyal to God to stand forward. Here we have it in Exodus 32 and verse 25. When Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose to the derision of their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, "Who is on the Lord's side, come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered around him. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother and his companion and his neighbor. And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, "Today you have been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of his son and of his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day." The Levites had as weapons of violence swords, but they turned them to the will of God, to the service of God. And God showed them mercy and made them priests among the people. So even though the word of Jacob comes true for them in that they are scattered among Israel, they are nevertheless blessed by God and made the priestly tribe. We see in this the lives of these two brothers and their descendants, the justice of God and the mercy of God displayed. I wonder what Judah thought at this time. Now, Judah was a sinner, and he knew it. He had slept with his daughter-in-law, albeit unknowingly. He had not fulfilled his vow to her in giving her one of his other sons. Judah was not a good man. But Judah had learned humility. He had been willing to take the place of Benjamin. He had sworn his life away to Jacob as protector of his younger brother. He was a changed man. But the very fact of his being a changed man, his new humility, Judah must not have expected to hear the words that his father spoke to him, having heard words of curse and judgment upon his three older brothers. But in this we see the promise of God and the fulfillment of God in the providence of God. It is God who is speaking. He speaks through Jacob's mouth, but this certainly is the word of God concerning Judah. He says, "Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, and as a lioness, who dares rouse him?" Judah is given the blessing of leadership among his brothers. He is given the role of ruler among the tribes. He is to be a powerful ruler, like a lion. No one will dare to come against him. Not only is he to be a powerful ruler, verse 10 tells us that his reign is to be eternal. "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." Now, there's great debate among the commentators as to that central phrase there in verse 10, translated in the ESV as "until tribute comes to him." You may have a footnote that indicates that it can be translated otherwise, as "until he comes to whom it belongs, or "until Shiloh comes," or "until he comes to Shiloh." And so there's an abundance of different translations there and lots of confusion as to what exactly it may mean. So how can we understand it then? Well, certainly there's an indication that the rule of Judah is to be long-lived. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, or until something else happens, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. I would argue, from what we know from the rest of Scripture, that the idea here is that the reign of Judah will be eternal. The very word "until" doesn't necessarily mean that an end will come at that point. Indeed, it can indicate the ongoing nature of the reign, and we find it to be personified in Jesus Christ, who himself is eternal, and therefore his kingship is an eternal kingship. He is a powerful ruler, an eternal ruler, and a prosperous ruler. Verse 11 tells us that he binds his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. The idea here is that these rich crops of the vine are so abundant that people can freely wash their clothes in them if they so chose. Wine will be as common as water. So rich will his, and prosperous will his reign be. And we see this all fulfilled. Fulfilled through David, through Solomon, but more importantly, fulfilled through David's greater son, Jesus, who is the eternal king on God's throne, who is powerful over every nation, and who prospers in all that he puts his hand to do. There seems to me to be a hint of something more, though, in these words. These words concerning garments being washed in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. It seems to me to indicate something of great significance. And though one or two commentators draw this out, not all do make the connection, whether because they don't see the connection there, or they don't believe that it is a valid connection to make. But nevertheless, this language is applied later on in the Bible. In fact, we've seen it in our studies in the book of Revelation. Not applied to the king himself, but to the followers of the king. In Revelation chapter 7 and verse 14, speaking concerning an innumerable host of people standing around the throne of God in robes of white, one of the elders addresses John and says, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." Not the blood of grapes, but the blood of the Lamb. The point, though, is that this Lamb is the king who has descended from Judah. He is the king who reigns eternally with sovereign power on the throne of God. He is the Lamb who has conquered all his enemies by his own death. And he is the Lamb who has propitiated the sins of his people by shedding his blood. He is the Lamb who is able to transform sinners into a people for God. He is the Lamb who is able to take violent, bloodthirsty men and make them into a kingdom of priests to God. He is the Lamb who is able to take the people of Israel, the children of Israel, from every nation under heaven and make them his kingdom to reign with him on his throne forever. And the difference that makes all of this possible is his willingness to come into this world to bear their sins, to shed his blood, to wash their garments in his blood, to make them white, pure, and perfect in the sight of God. The hopes and dreams of all the years fulfilled in this one who came. The prophecies of Jacob brought to their climax in this one man who was willing to leave all of his glory in heaven to take the place of sinners on earth. And this is our heritage if we will trust in him. This is for us. They're not the ways of men. If man had planned the salvation of humanity, he'd have done it in a very different way from this. It is a plan that involves both justice and mercy of a sovereign God who makes promises and fulfills those promises through his own providence. And he's at work in our lives today in ways perhaps that we don't expect, showing us mercy rather than justice because of this one who reigns and pleads for us in heaven. Let us live for him. Let us trust in him. Let us serve him.